page 526. Ah. Sunday. Just before we start, I'll take this opportunity to inform you all, if you don't know, and invite you. On Tuesday morning, Tuesday is the 20th anniversary of Savitri Bhavani. On the 24th of November in 1995, Nirod Baran laid the foundation stone under the teak trees there. And this Tuesday in the morning, we shall be laying for the next element of our complex, the Sangam Hall, which will be a big hall that can accommodate about 200 people, where we can hold Savitri readings on a larger scale, where the Om Choir can be accommodated, and other events like the Natkana Memorial Lecture and so on. So if it's not raining too hard, and if you're free and if you would like to come, you're welcome to be with us from 10:45 on Tuesday morning. But if it's pouring with rain, don't bother to come. We will have a very small ceremony because it will be in the open under the trees. Well, last week, in spite of the weather, there were 15 people here, some guests, and we read up to the end of the first section at the top of page 526. And then we just simply read this short section that comes on page 526 to 27, which will be very nice for us to study this morning. Savitri, the canto is called The Finding of the Soul, and at the top of page 526, it explains, there suddenly she met her secret soul. And in this short section that comes next, it is explained what that means, meeting the soul. You'll start, Norman? Norman?
Yes.
Would you begin? Yeah.
A being, but immortal, in transience, deathless dallying with momentary things, in whose wide eyes of tranquil happiness, which pity and sorrow could not abrogate, infinity turned its gaze on finite shapes. Observer of the silent steps of the hours, eternity upheld the minute's act, and the passing scenes of the everlasting's play. In the mystery of its selecting will, in the divine comedy, a participant, the spirit's conscious representative, God's delegate in our humanity, comrade of the universe, the transcendence ray, she had come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance.
Thank you. We're on page 526. You want to take it?
Yeah.
You were in such a hurry to come in. Suddenly, Savitri met her secret soul. And then comes the description. A being stood, immortal in transience. We are transient, or our bodies are transient, but dwelling within our bodies, within our transient beings, there's an immortal being, and that being is deathless, but it plays with momentary things. Dallying means not taking too seriously, playing with. That being has wide eyes of tranquil happiness, but within that happiness, there is pity and sorrow, but that pity and sorrow does not abrogate, it can't cancel out or contradict the calm happiness which is there. In those eyes, infinity is looking out on finite shapes, all the limited, defined shapes of our human world. That being is an observer of the silent steps of the hours. She's observing the passing of time. And in her eternity is upholding, supporting all the small actions of all the many minutes and all the passing scenes, one scene after another, of the everlasting's play, the play of the everlasting and eternal in the world. She, that being, has come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance. With the ball, you pass it around and toss it backwards and forwards. So there's something playful in her relationship, her cooperative relationship with time and circumstance. Because she is God's delegate in our humanity. A delegate is somebody that you send to represent you. So the Supreme has delegated the soul to represent him in our humanity as a comrade of the universe. Again, a comrade is a playmate and a friend and a supporter. She's come as a ray, a single ray of light coming from the Supreme, from the Transcendent. She's a participant in the divine comedy. The divine comedy and tragedy of evolution, of manifestation. And she's a representative of the spirit which is choosing things here in the mystery of its selecting will. In the manifestation, the spirit chooses certain things, actions, behaviors. So she, this being within, is the representative of the selecting will of the everlasting, of the spirit. Is it clear anybody would like to ask anything or share anything? This is the being whom Savitri sees when she breaks through this wall of doorless living fire. Mm. And the description continues. You'd like to read? Yeah. Mihong, yeah.
A joy in the world, a master movement here. The passion of the game lighted her eyes, a smile on her lips welcomed others' bliss and grief. A laugh was her return to pleasure and pain. All the things she saw as a masquerade of truth, disguised in the costumes of her ignorance. Crossing the years to immortality, all she could front with the strong, sweet peace. But since she knows the toil of mind and life, as a mother feels and shares her children's lives, she puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of men, into a hidden region of the heart, to face the pain and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure others' wounds, and labor meet the labor of the stars.
Thank you. Anything to ask?
A laugh was a return to pleasure and pain. She's laughing at our pain, or she's receiving pain with laughter?
Well, she's experiencing all this, and she's taking part in this game of existence, and she's enjoying it. The main movement of this being is a joy in the world. She sees it as a game, and the enjoyment and the intensity of the game is lighting her eyes. So she plays this game with a smile on her lips, welcomed Earth's bliss and grief. And whatever happens, whatever experience comes, a laugh is her return to pleasure and pain. It might be like that if you're playing a game that you're very good at and that you enjoy very much. It doesn't really matter if something goes wrong, you know, it is still fun. And she can do this because she sees everything that happens as a masquerade of truth, disguised in the costumes of ignorance. A masquerade is when you dress up and people put on masks so you can't see who is who. No? So all these forms and happenings of Earth, she sees these as disguised expressions of truth, disguised in the costumes of the ignorance. So we see so many things that aren't as they should be, and we feel distressed and pained by them. We feel distressed and pained by them because they are not a full divine expression of things as they should be. They're disguised in the costumes of the ignorance. And we too are in the ignorance. So we don't see the truth behind, which is supporting wearing all these clothes. But she can see it, no? So, yeah.
And what about that small portion she puts forth?
Well, that's the next thing, yes?
Why does it forget the bliss?
She, so that it can play the game. It's like an actor when he's been given a role, a difficult role to play, complex role. He can't all the time remember, oh, I'm Tom Smith acting Hamlet. He has to forget who he is and play the part fully. So she puts a portion of herself, a portion of her knowledge, her bliss, her strength, her bliss especially. She puts that, the Indian scripture says it's no bigger than a human thumb. And it's seated deep within our hearts here. That's the psychic being, yes. And the job of that small soul is to face all the pain, to forget the bliss. But a memory lingers, otherwise we wouldn't be aspiring for the bliss and missing for it, no? Missing it. It's there to share the suffering, to experience the suffering, but to be strong enough to share it, able to endure all the wounds of Earth. And it's there to participate in the work of this manifestation, which is evolving from everything being apparently unconscious gas, there's no particles even, no. The labor of the stars, all the effort and labor that is going on in the whole universe, we are also participating, each of us in our own small way, with this vast ongoing process, the labor of the stars.
Crossing the years to immortality, so that you become aware of what's on there.
Yes.
Go on towards immortality.
Yeah. If we think, if we fixedly believe, as many things try to convince us to believe, that it will always be like this, no, then you're really hopeless. But if you can see that all this is in movement, it's part of a big process, and that all these figures of the ignorance are moving towards the immortal state, to immortality. That makes it more understandable, more acceptable.
more bearable. Yam, do you like to read? Hmm? It says this. This is that little figure in the heart. Hmm?
This, in us laughs and weeps, and weeps, suffers a stroke, exalts in victory, struggles for the crown, identified with the mind and body and life. It takes on itself their anguish and defeat, bleeds with fate's whips, and hangs upon the cross. Yet it is unwounded and immortal self, supporting the actor in the human scene. Through this, she sends us her glory and powers, pushes to wisdom's heights, through misery's gulfs. She gives us strength to do our daily task, and sympathy that partakes of others' grief, and the little strength we have to help our race. We, who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape, and on our shoulders carry the struggling world.
Thank you. We human beings are the ones who must play the role of the universe, becoming conscious, acting itself out in this slight, this small human shape. So we carry a great responsibility on our shoulders. We carry on our shoulders the whole struggling world. There are several places in the poem and many places in the Life Divine and his other writings where Sri Aurobindo points out again and again that we imperfect, ignorant human beings have a very, very important role to play in the evolutionary process, because in the whole course of evolution, we are the only ones, so far, we have developed a consciousness that can look around, ask questions, work out answers, an intelligent will that can make choices, conscious choices. So behind is this little portion which is driving us, pushing us. The greater soul above uses this little soul to push us to the heights of wisdom, support us through all the terrible gulfs, the deep places of misery that so many human beings have to pass through. She gives us the strength to do our work every day. She gives us sympathy so that we can share and feel the sufferings of others. And whatever little strength we have to help our race, to help humanity. We who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape. We who must carry on our shoulders the struggling world.
So this is why we feel sometimes in our bodies something, perhaps we don't know what's happening on the world scene, but it's affecting us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. We're part of everything.
Helping humanity through charity and benevolence and philanthropy, or a different way of helping humanity?
Well, we have a little strength to help our race. We can't just lie back and live selfishly and not do anything. No. But if we want to help, there are some ways. But he says it's only a little strength. We don't have much, we can't do much. It's only really when the spiritual being in us has fully evolved and established us itself, then we can help. He says you can, we can, if we allow the soul to guide us, it is possible for us to alleviate and succor. Succor means help, and alleviate means to lessen the load of other people. But we can't really transform anything. So far, everything that we do is a kind of preparation. And the most important thing is our own inner development. Only when that has evolved completely, then we'll be able to help. So whatever small help we may seem to be able to do, we should be very modest about it. It's really coming from the divine within.
Whatever comes to our life, you don't have to seek out and try to help.
Not necessarily. But we should remember that we have this responsibility to participate in the evolutionary process. That means be the best person that we possibly can be.
To make it in the best way, that we have to try this inner work to meet the secret soul. Yeah. That then you can be more step back and can help.
Yeah. Aaron, would you read the next bit? No? Patricia? This
is in us the garden, small and mild. In this human portion of divinity, she seeks the greatness of the soul in time to uplift from light to light, from power to power, till on a heavenly peak it stands a king. In body weak, in its heart an invincible might, the kinds stumbling, held up by an unseen hand, a toiling spirit in a mortal shape.
Thank you.
She exactly.
So this is the being who stands immortal in transience. This, we can say, this is the oversoul, this our central being, which is always supporting us from behind, but she supports us mostly through this portion of herself, which she seats in our hearts. So here they meet. Helmut, you would read.
Here, in this temple of flame and light, they looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm, immortal, and the struggling soul. Then, with a magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and flew on.
Thank you. Savitri's search for her soul begins on page 477, 30 pages back. Before that, we saw her deeply in love with Satyavan and suffering from the terrible ordeal of knowing that he must die in 1 year's time, and that date of his death is drawing nearer and nearer. We saw human Savitri not knowing what to do in this situation, with her courage hiding the knowledge that only she has, her love growing more and more intense with the knowledge that soon Satyavan won't be with her any longer, and suffering this terrible grief, a grief which we can hardly imagine. And not able to communicate it or share it with anybody, she has to keep that knowledge to herself. And in that state, we saw in the night when Satyavan was sleeping, a voice came to her from her being summits, from the very highest level of her being, and said, "You have to find your soul. And when you find your soul, when you remember why you came, what is your mission, then I will be able to give you all my force and you will be able to conquer death and dying." And we said then, when we read that command, that of course in the legend, in the poem, Savitri is shown as a very special person. She's come as a direct emanation of the Supreme Divine Mother with a very special mission of making a big leap forward in human evolution possible, in the universal evolution. But in a way, if that voice comes to us from our heights and reminds us, remember why thou camest, find out thy soul, recover thy hid self, in silence seek God's meaning in thy depths, then mortal nature change to the divine. That's a kind of command, or at least a possibility, that all of us are offered. We have that little portion of the Supreme hidden in the deep within our hearts, and we can find it out and remember what is the unique mission that we came here to do. All of us have a unique contribution to make, and as human beings, we all share the mission of preparing this next step in evolution beyond the mental being to the spiritual being, towards the supramental being. So in those intervening 30 pages, Sri Aurobindo has shown us the way. Savitri undertakes this search for the soul to show us the way. The chapter is called The Parable of the Search for the Soul. It's something that has a wider meaning. It's not just for Savitri. These experiences that she passes through, these are the experiences that all of us can pass through as we search. So there's the entry into the inner countries, the country of the subconscious physical, the vital, the different levels of mind, and then there's the approach, coming close to the soul. And we, in the beginning of this canto, we saw Savitri as entering deep inside herself, as if into a rock temple with many, many rooms, and the walls of the rooms all illustrated with significant forms and shapes, and her gradually understanding, identifying with all those forms and shapes and what they meant, and finally passing through this wall of living flame and suddenly meeting her secret soul. And then having this understanding that there's a permanent being dwelling, immortal, in our transience. And that's a great being who is not touched or wounded in any way, but she puts a little portion of herself in each of us to bear all the experiences that we have to have as human beings. And these two consciously recognize each other and become one. So Savitri has found her soul. This is a crucial experience in the life of any human being. Sri Aurobindo and Mother call it the psychic realization. And as a consequence of the psychic realization can come about a transformation. That means not just there's an inner experience and a knowledge, that experience and that knowledge has the power to change our whole being. And that's what's described next. In ordinary human beings, in human life, this contact with the psychic may not come so suddenly like this, and the process of it doing its work of transformation in human nature may take decades or lives. But here Sri Aurobindo has put it all together so that we can see the whole process.
We get this small portion in ourselves, that is the divinity which has to be developed. And is it then also that, what is this aspect to come in union with the Divine Mother? That would be then the great one soul?
Yes, that's what happens here at the bottom of the section. You have to find the little soul in yourself first, and then that can identify itself with its own greater self.
And they often mentioned the only thing is a union, with the divine.
So this is the way to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sri Aurobindo speaks of these three stages. And we will see now, we will go on with this canto, we'll see what happens to Savitri next. And the very, very great happiness and trust and confidence that it brings to her. But then she has to pass through another terrible ordeal. And that is, then she's shown that this realization you've had now is not enough to enable you to do what you've, to conquer death. That's a big thing to do. So in order to conquer death, you have another step to take. And that is conveyed in Cantos 6 and 7, which we will go on to read later. And then she really has to implement all that. Then comes the death, the book of death, and the passage through the worlds beyond death, and only finally, in the middle of book 11, comes the real conquest, the fulfillment of her mission. And then Sri Aurobindo, in the words of the Supreme, prophesies what that will mean for Savitri individually and what that will mean for the whole world. So here we're at quite an important stage. Savitri has found her soul. So what's the next step? You will read, Margaret.
Once more, she was a woman upon earthly soil. In the muttering night, amid the rain swept woods, at the rude cottage where she sat in trance. That subtle world withdrew deeply within, behind the sun veil of the inner side. But now the half-opened lotus bud of her heart had bloomed and stood disclosed to the earthly ray. In an image shown revealed her secret soul.
Shall we look at that sentence first? Yeah. So she's back in her body, in the little house, in the woods, and all those subtle worlds where she's been moving in her consciousness, in her subtle bodies, withdrew, and she's not aware of them anymore. They're veiled by this sun veil of the inner sight, as if it's a light that's so bright you can't look through it to what is behind. But now she's aware of what had been the half-opened bud, the lotus bud, the chakra, the heart, deep heart chakra, has blossomed, bloomed, and it stood disclosed to the earthly ray. In her earthly consciousness, she can see it. She's aware of it in the form of an image. In an image shone, revealed her secret soul. So she's moving on to a new kind of experience where she's aware of her physical being and deep within it, this wonderful blossom. There was no wall severing the soul and mind, no mystic fence guarding from the claims of life. In its deep lotus home, her being sat, as if on concentration's marble seat, calling the mighty mother of the worlds to make this earthly tenement her house, as in a flash from a supernal light, a living image of the original power, a face, a form, came down into her heart and made of it its temple and pure abode. A tenement is a dwelling place that doesn't belong to you. It's a temporary place to stay. So Sri Aurobindo often speaks of the body as a house. Here, this is this earthly tenement. It's this house where we are just a tenant. Our true being will move on to other houses. So there, Savitri is identified with her soul and calling the great being, the mighty mother of the worlds, to come and enter into this little physical form of hers. And it happens, as in a flash of supernal light, a living image of that original power, the mighty mother of the worlds, a face and a form came down into Savitri's heart and inhabited it as its temple, its shrine, a pure place for it to live. So this in itself is an incredible experience and very, very important experience. But then it has an effect also, an extremely powerful effect.
Then it could be as a touch the quivering bloom. A mighty movement rocked the inner space as if a world were shaken and found its soul. Out of the inconscient, soulless, mindless night, a flaming serpent rose, released from sleep. It rose, drawing its coils and stood erect and climbing mightily, stormily on its way. It touched her center with its flaming mouth, as if a fiery kiss had broken their sleep. They bloomed and left, surcharged with light and bliss.
Yes, let's pause there. The quivering bloom is this lotus center of Savitri's heart, the soul center. No? So this living image of the mighty mother comes down into her heart, accepts to inhabit, to live there, to dwell there. And when the feet of that living image touched that center, there's a sudden mighty movement of the whole inner space, like an earthquake, more than an earthquake, as if a world were shaken and had found its soul, and its meaning, its reason for existence. And up out of the darkness, the soulless, mindless night, this flaming serpent rose. It has been sleeping down there in the darkness. And now at the touch of the mother's feet, it rises up. It's a flaming serpent, a serpent. We've met these serpents before. They are always energies. This is a very, very powerful energy. And this moves up through her body, standing erect, it's standing on its tail, up. And as it moves up through the subtle centers in the body, what we call the chakras, as the mouth of the serpent touches each of these centers, they open, they are awoken. Sometimes nowadays we see beautiful time-lapse photography of flowers opening. Well, this is happening suddenly like that. Each of these lotus centers is blooming, laughing, surcharged, absolutely full, overfull with light and bliss. One by one they all open. You like to read? Would you like to read?
Then at the crown, enjoying the eternal space, in the flower of Rihe, in the flower of Nile's bay, in each divine stronghold and nature's symbol, it held together the mystic stream which joins the viewless summits with the unseen depth. The string of forts that make the frail defense, safeguarding us against the enormous world, our lines of self-expression in its bars.
Thank you. It's another very, very dense sentence we can look at, contemplate. Perhaps most of us are familiar with this concept of the chakras, these centers which join the physical body with the subtle planes. And perhaps you have already some kind of feeling of where they are. You might have experienced some kind of movement in them. Theoretically, here, just above the crown, is where the head of the serpent joins the eternal space, the timeless, transcendent realm. And so that's the flower of the head, and there's the flower of matter's base, which is corresponding to the base of our spine. But in the subtle body, he says each of these is a divine stronghold. And later on he says a fort. It's like a strong place. And they are all each also knots of nature. They keep things tied together, connected. So this flow of energy, which is the serpent, is holding together this mystic stream of consciousness which joins the viewless summits, those highest levels of consciousness and existence which we cannot see, which are beyond the manifestation, with the unseen depths, those very deep layers which we also don't see, at the base of our existence. Each of those centers is like a string of forts. They are defending our individual existence, safeguarding us as individualized beings against the enormous world. We can have contact with the enormous world through them, but they are keeping us safe. Otherwise, we might dissolve into the universal soup. And they also represent, provide our lines of self-expression in the vastness of the universe. And each of them corresponds to a different mode of expression: the mind, the will, vision, creative expression, emotions, sensations, hungers, and then this all-important base, our basic energy which connects us with the physical.
So there is this aspect, safeguarding us against the enormous world, how there is expressed in it, how important it is to, how you say, be conscious of the I and to defenses also, to say yes to the individuality.
Yes.
Otherwise, we, as you said, we just get
well,
lost, no?
Well, normally we don't have much choice about it. But it can be that through some kind of exceptional opening, one or other of these centers, or maybe all of them, opens unexpectedly. And then in our individual being, we may not know how to cope with that. To other people, we may seem then, or we may be, out of control of ourselves. We can be here and behave crazily, as if we are out of control. So there's a reason why we are here in individual bodies and in individual personalities, in individual shapes. And Sri Aurobindo has emphasized to us that just merging into the vast is not our ultimate destiny. No. But there's a reason in this individualization, and a purpose. And these chakras, these are energy centers that help us in that process.
It also comes to me about the consciousness. And I mean, a lot of women have this consciousness always to merge in the families and all these things, and it seems also the conscious aspiration to take, be conscious of their own personality, or their own being. This, the consciousness is also one aspect of it.
Do you like to read, Mom? Wait a moment. Start two lines above that. An image set.
Okay. An image set of the original power, wearing the mighty mother's form and face, bearer of the weapon and sign, whose upper might no magic can imitate, manifold yet one, she said, a guardian force, a savior gesture, stretch a lifted arm, and symbol of some native cosmic strength, a sacred beast lay prone below her feet, a silent, flame-eyed mass of living force.
Yes, thank you. Of the mother in this form, with a lion or a tiger beneath her feet, with her weapon, her sign, lifting her hand in blessing. Some images show her with many, 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 many arms. These are signs of all her powers, manifold, and yet one, she sat, guardian force. So that image is no longer just in Savitri's heart, it's in her whole being. We can go a little further. Thera.
All underwent a high celestial change breaking the black unconscious blind mute wall, effacing the circles of the ignorance, powers and divinities burst flaming forth. Each part of the being trembling with delight lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness and saw her hand in every circumstance and felt her touch in every limb and cell. In the country of the lotus of the head, which thinking mind has made its busy space, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, whence it shoots the arrows of its sight and will, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, where speech must rise and the expressing mind and the heart's impulse run towards word and act, a glad uplift and a new working came. The immortal's thoughts displaced our bounded view. The immortal's thoughts, earth, dread, idea, and sense. All things now bore a deeper, heavenlier sense. A glad, clear harmony marked their truth outline, reset the balance and measures of the world. Each shape showed its occult design, God's meaning in it for which it was made, and the vivid splendor of his artist's thought.
Thank you.
So the serpent moved upwards, but Sri Aurobindo is describing the transformation step by step, starting with the head. The head, the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, where it shoots the arrows of its sight and will. Passage of the lotus of the throat, where the speech comes out, we express mind, and we express the impulses of the heart in action, in word and in action. So, a glad uplift and a new working gain. The next lines describe the effect of this transformation in perception, and in thought and action. And that description of the change continues further. But I think we will stop there for today. If anybody has any further questions to ask, we can deal with those. There are two very special paintings in the Meditations on Savitri series. This one shows the movement upwards of the serpent, and the next one shows the blossoming of all the centers, position in the subtle being.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same like Kundalini?
So that serpent is what is referred to as the rising of the Kundalini. Yes. We are told that the Buddha himself chose not to dissolve, no?
Yeah.
he had all the realizations that he could. And then at least one version says that he decided not to take that step until all sentient beings, I think that is the phrase used, so it is all beings that show some consciousness are liberated. So certainly what bothered me with Vipassana when I took that course was that the aim of the meditation seemed to be to convince us of the illusoriness of our experiences.
But this is the first time, but deeply this is that we are so, I put, but in the meditation, I put on all my life, that in all our
information,
this is the imperfection, the decline of the path, but still, things,
yes, so all this is a purifying process.
Until end of life, have to do. But, and then, after finish, and then some people become the arahant, fully enlightened, then so what? They just disappear.
Yes, that is the unsatisfactoriness of some traditional forms of spirituality, which Aurobindo has addressed by saying that this idea that all this is illusory is not correct. His approach is omnipresent reality. Everything is real. Everything is real. The inner experiences, the outer experiences, everything. It is all real. The important thing is to see the connection between these realities. And the method of Vipassana, I think, can be very good for becoming aware of all the different movements and even having a way of purifying oneself from certain movements. Or they get automatically purified by your awareness. So all these methods have some utility. What is really important for each of us individually is to know what is our aim, which nobody can prescribe for us really. We have to find our own truth, our own approach to truth, to the omnipresent reality. That all these spiritual disciplines and methods, they can be helpful in their place. And perhaps once we have this discovery of the psychic being, that helps us a great deal to discriminate what is helpful to us in our path and what we can leave to other people in their path. So,
and I have another question.
Yes,
Andrew. Because of the serpent and the Kundalini, it came to my mind somewhere I read in one of the books that there was like beginners in yoga or something.
Sorry?
I read in one of the books, I think beginners in yoga, that it should receive people who had already some Kundalini realization because traditionally the energy goes down, up.
Yes, so that is important here, that this Kundalini experience comes to Savitri as a result of the descent of the Supreme Mind. So that is what Aurobindo discourages, is us going down into the base chakra and trying to do the work there. Then the circle, the energy may rise up, and that can cause a lot of disorders in the physical and in the subtle being if it isn't sufficiently purified first. So that is why in his yoga he recommends us, you don't worry about Kundalini or anything like that. you go for the psychic discovery, psychic transformation, and if and when it's necessary for Kundalini to rise, it will do so when you're sufficiently purified. Mm.
And if we can't...
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then take it to somebody, they didn't find the lucky being, and then both they Kundalini isn't, they can't control something.
That's it, loss of control.
Maybe some people that Kundalini will kill you or something.
It can do that, yes. And some people of my generation have had such experiences as the result of taking drugs, and never recover.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, probably eventually the soul recovers, but it's not advised. It's not advised in any of the paths, actually, except to do it very carefully under the guidance of a guru, of a person who really knows. So all these books dealing with these tantric processes and so on, they are also all locked away in the ashram library. They're not freely available.
So now there is like in the West, the modern Kundalini yoga from Yogi Bhajan.
Mm.
Lots of kriyas to activate the Kundalini. So it could be dangerous?
It could be dangerous. I don't know the quality of the guru. I think this kind of popularizing of these very drastic tapasyas, it's not without risk. But that there is a truth underlying it and that it has a place in the full spiritual development, this we should recognize and acknowledge. We can close listening to Mother reading some of these passages.
A being stood immortal in transience, deathless delight with momentary things. She had come into the mortal body's room, but since she knows the toil of mind and life, as a mother feels and shares her children's lives, she puts forth a small portion of herself. A being no bigger than the sum of man, into a hidden region of the heart, to face the pang and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure earth and labor mid the labor of the stars. Here in this chamber of flame and light, they met. They looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul. Then, with a magic transformation speed, they hushed into each other and grew one. Muttering night amid the rain swept wood and the rude cottage where she sat in class. But now the half open lotus bud of her heart had bloomed and stood disclosed to the earthly rays in an image shown revealed her secret soul. In its deep lotus home her being set as if on concentration's marvelous seat, calling the mighty mother of the world to make this earthly tenement her house. As in a flash from a supernal light, a living image of the original power, a face, a form, came down into her heart and made of it its temple and pure abode. Out of the inconscient, soulless, mindless night, a flaming serpent arose, released from sleep. Its robe billowing its coils and stood erect, and climbing mightily, stormily on its way. It touched her centers with its flaming mouth, as if a fiery kiss had broken their sleep. They bloomed and laughed, surcharged with light and bliss. Then, as the crown it joined the eternal space. All underwent a high celestial change, breaking the black inconscience blind mute wall. Each part of the being trembling with delight lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness. in the country of the lotus of the head, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, in the kingdom of the lotus of the heart, in the narrow lotus's broad imperial range, in the narrow nether center's petty part, in the deep place where once the serpent slept, a firm ground was made for heaven's descending might.
Thanks to Shrapnel.